Good evening and welcome to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson, I'm the director of the National Art Gallery of the Bahamas, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. Don't forget, you can also listen to us when you are on the move by downloading the TuneIn app from the App Store or the Play Store, and that will allow you to find radio stations, and you will find 96.9, and you can listen to us all day. But you particularly want to listen on Wednesday evenings, because that's when the art and culture and the good stuff happens. So tonight, we are not leaving the island, because we have a visitor who came to the island, but we are speaking with someone from outside of the Bahamas art world, but who's been here a few times now, who is a very dear friend, but also a colleague for many years, and his name is Camilo Alvarez. Good evening, Camilo.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Camilo. Camilo is, well, you know what? Camilo's been done a little bit of everything. Camilo's a friend, but most recently he had an art gallery for 13 years.
13.
Lucky 13. Lucky 13 in Boston. And he represented a lot of emerging artists, and now he's on to new projects. But first of all, why don't you just and Camilo is one of the reasons he's here, aside from being a friend and a colleague, is he's also from the region. So he's originally from the Dominican Republic, but grew up in the Bronx in New York. And so, you know, he's someone that is concerned a lot of the issues that we're concerned with down here in terms of, you know, post-colonialism, in terms of people of color in the art world and access for artists and dealers and all kinds of things. And so we're going to discuss some of those things today. So Camilo, you grew up in the Bronx. How did you get into art? Was that something your family was around your family or
I mean, I think culture in general was something my family was interested in. So, yeah, I was born in 1976 in New York, the city so nice they named it twice. And then we lived in the Dominican Republic. So my parents really wanted me to get, you know, a better worldly understanding. And so we moved to the Dominican Republic, Santo Domingo. They also wanted me to learn Spanish, of course. So I lived there till I was 17 and then came back to the Bronx, did 2 years of high school in the Bronx. Then I was sent up to upstate New York for college, Skidmore College, where basically in high school is where I really kind of got the itch. And, you know, it was in Walton High School. It was a, you know, first time going there, you know, in the morning I had to go through security. And that was a cultural, you know, kind of a shock to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure.
And so then, you know, I went to, at one point went to a, you know, an art exhibition. You know, I really hadn't really been to museums or stuff like that. And it was the Basquiat exhibition at the Whitney. And it was beautiful to see, you know, Madison Avenue, Doms mixing with these rough and tumble Bronx kids. And they were all having the same reaction. And I was like, yeah, this is the great equalizer, I think, for me, art. And so I knew early on I didn't want to make art. I kind of knew I wanted to present it. I knew I wanted to elicit and present the reactions that this audience was feeling. And so from right then on, I decided I wanted to study art history.
And well, I'm sure it's not also a coincidence that it was a Basquiat show, so an artist of color who kind of, and one of the, I won't say one of the first, because there were a lot of great artists of color working previous to that. You know, you think of somebody like Frank Bowling or, I mean, a lot of people, but they weren't really recognized, right? And there are people, we can talk about that later, sort of working now on kind of including people in the canon who were excluded because of color. But I'd say that Basquiat was probably the first kind of household name.
Absolutely.
Of contemporary art.
Yeah. And then it also helped that he had a similar silhouette to me.
Right.
He had a similar skin tone to me. So that was, you know, it was accessible. And so from then on, you know, I went up to upstate Skidmore College, studied art history. And then after the 4 years of that, it was a small private liberal arts college. It's very, you know, segmented, if you will. Came back to New York and I worked for, I immediately had an internship at the Met because I really wanted to be in quote-unquote art historian.
Right, like a scholar.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I noticed it was mostly dead white men.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That got kind of a little old real quick. But in the meantime, also...
Well, and not just dead old white men you're studying, but also, I mean, you know, I'm like at least have the whiteness of when I was studying art history, but as a woman, right?
Yeah,
so, I mean,
absolutely.
You know, you I'm sure would have been like a real minority among the people studying as well, right?
I mean,
so, because that also was very much, you know, all the great art historians that we all studied as students were all white men too, right?
Yeah, but it was a limited conversation.
Yeah, and well, because they read art in a certain way, right? They read it through their lens, and everything we learned about art was all about how you see it from one point of view.
Highly classist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was very, very, the message wasn't, you know, as holistic as I wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, I also had an internship at Exit Art, which was this amazing alternative art space that was founded by this Jewish New York woman and her Puerto Rican husband.
Mm-hmm.
And it was highly inclusive and, you know, it was contemporary art. So it was working with living artists. Established emerging and mid-career artists, and the mediums were from photography and painting, you know, to performance and video, mm-hmm. which were the latest, you know, mediums. And, you know, at the end of that summer, I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to stay with Exit Art. So I was there for a couple years.
Yeah, and they were really pretty important in the New York art scene in expanding
Soho.
Things. Yeah, Soho, and it was from 1982 to 2012, so 30-year run.
30-year run.
Yeah.
So, you know, and mind you, for within a nonprofit, you know, it's more work, less money.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So I, you know, in the meantime, so I left them. I was there for a couple of years. And for, you know, several years, I was telling you the other day, I had a different job every day of the week for about 3 or 4 years. I drove an art delivery truck around the city and also through the country. I worked in art delivery, you know, storage companies. I worked for artists and artist studios. I worked for commercial galleries, installing art, you know, what have you. I mean, just basic New York situation.
Yeah. And but also learning so much, right?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, that's
learning the craft by just doing, right?
I thought I had a really back room access. You know, I mm-hmm. got to see how artworks were handled, how they were spoken, how they were written about,
mm-hmm.
but then also I got to preview the shows before anybody
mm-hmm.
did,
mm-hmm.
so it was kind of, you know, a really nice position. In the meantime, I was looking for a cozy job with benefits,
mm-hmm.
right, because
sure.
I was, you know, getting more mature, so I bumped into the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture, which is an amazing residency. The offices are in New York, but they have, the residency actually happens for 9 weeks in the middle of Maine,
mm-hmm.
and I was there for 2 years, and that was like Shangri-La, you know, and basically I was the program associate, and you know, surrounded by 65 artists from all around the world, mostly, you know, emerging, some were mid-career, and, you know, age difference was like 22 to 60.
Yeah.
So it was pretty wide range.
And it's very regarded. I think any artist that has Skowhegan on their CV as a residency is already kind of pegged to be somebody who's going to go somewhere. And actually, I'm very proud to say that we've had, I think, at least one Bahamian through that program.
Yeah.
I know that LeVar Monroe was there. I'm not sure if Janine Antoni ever did that.
Janine Antoni's on the Board of
Governors. Oh, she's on the Board of Governors.
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
So we have a Bahamian on the Board of Governors.
Yeah, so it's in a unique
But mind you, we can talk about that later.
Okay.
I would say that most Bahamians probably don't know who Janine Antoni is.
Okay.
Which is kind of like an issue that we have here about how we value and respect people who have succeeded in the art world. Like, we all know who the Olympians are. We
that
all know.
Gives me chills, because she's one of the most important female contemporary artists around.
Like, ever. I know.
I mean,
but
like
anyhow.
Ever, yeah.
We'll talk about that later. So anyhow, you're at Skowhegan.
So Skowhegan was great. You know, I mean, so it was, that really fostered kind of this network. I mean, I think in New York, you're kind of a little bit removed. Mind you, I was born in New York, but I think New York has lost its transgression a lot in the past years. The art world itself has gotten highly financialized. So to be in Skowhegan, where all the conversations revolved around the work, was incredibly important for
mm-hmm.
me to, like, gain confidence in myself. So after those 2 years, I decided, you know what? I needed to leave New York.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody should leave where they
where they're from. Yeah,
where
I think so
from.
Too. Yeah.
So I moved to Boston, not only for, you know, for that, but also for love.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the best reasons. But
yes.
Yeah.
Camila has a wonderful wife. Fantastic. And her sister is a very well-known contemporary artist, too. So,
yeah.
So it all stays in the family.
Yeah.
But that goes. So if the love hadn't happened, because I have to say also, like, you know, you speak to your profile. It's a shame it's radio. Camila is a very, very tall man of color with big locks. And Boston doesn't seem to me like the most friendly. I remember going up there as a student when I had a Puerto Rican boyfriend, and let me tell you, it was not welcoming.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I think people always think of the US South as being highly racist,
yeah.
But the North is probably well camouflaged.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, it financed
yeah.
the Southern slavery
yeah, of course.
Situation.
Yeah.
So it's a genteel veneer of, you know, progressiveness,
mm-hmm.
I think. But anyway, I mean, it's also Boston's a institutional hub, highly you know, a lot of colleges, universities. So when I first got there, I realized, you know, I never worked in a institutional educational gallery setting. So
mm-hmm.
I my friend Jane Farver, who is now deceased, she was the director of the List Visual Arts Center. And so I became their, I was like a freelance contractor. I put together a couple of catalogs and symposiums and panels. And then I quickly realized, I didn't want to work in the academic setting.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed, you know, Boston's art environment, contemporary art environment, you know, could use a person of color behind the helm instead of, like, you know, on the walls, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I opened up a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, now in retrospect, there's no regrets. I mean, I think it's been an incredibly enlightening and rewarding experience. I mean, you've seen me grow, Amanda.
Yep, I have.
It was 13 years of mayhem.
Yep.
And then in the meantime, you know, I think I realized early on that I didn't want to represent artists, but because of the, you know, proliferation of the art fair, which, you know, required you to represent artists, I represented artists. And, you know, in the beginning, it was mostly all emerging. And then I started working with some mid-career artists. But I knew that the program had to have emerging, mid-career, and established artists in order to kind of flesh out, you know, because for an emerging artist to just show with other emerging artists, it doesn't include them in the canon. It doesn't,
it's true.
You know, add to the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And also just from a very basic financial standpoint, it's really, really hard to manage a gallery on emerging artists because the ticket is just, you know, and again, it's a very complicated question. And, you know, we're in a country where the conversation is still quite young. And I know that, you know, even in the countries where it's very developed, you know, artists feel, you know, you're taking your 50% and they resent that. But, you know, having, and I can understand why, right? Because they're putting their soul into their work and they're like, whoa, you're taking, but then on the other hand, knowing so many dealers that I do, having been married to an art dealer for so long, you know, I really know the struggle that dealers go through who put all their faith in these artists and support them and act like they're psychologists and they're bankers and teach them how to, you know, and put their money on the line too, right? Because, you know, to rent the space, to pay the staff, to hold the parties, to pay for the wine, to print the catalogs. And the costs are exorbitant. And very often galleries, even taking 50%, don't make it. They don't because the costs are more. And
so,
especially if you're representing emerging. If you start representing mid-career or secondary market where you can get a bigger ticket per work, then maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
yeah.
it's very different selling, you know, an emerging artist who just got out of grad school and their price points are not more than 2,000 and they're, you know, getting 50% of that versus, let's say, a Damien Hirst, which are selling for 300,000 and getting 10% of that. I mean, you do the math, of course.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the thing is for it, to get the exposure to, you know, raise an artist's, you know, capacities and to get them exposure is what we're to get eyes on the work.
Mm-hmm.
And so art fairs.
Yeah.
Advertising,
yeah.
You know, openings. It's a super social, you know, and when you think of these are unique objects,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's only one of them.
And you're putting a lot of effort into just one. You can't, exactly, it's not like you're producing something that once you get that to the market, you're like, oh, now I can sell 10 of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
It's not like you're building a brand either. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Artists are building their brands.
Artists are building. I think galleries have brands
well,
a little
now,
bit.
The,
now
the
they
big
do.
Big time
yeah.
galleries.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
a whole different, you
yeah.
know, I mean, that's the corporatization of the art world right there,
mm-hmm.
the financialization
mm-hmm.
of it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so listen, we're going to have to go to a quick break and we'll talk more about that after the break. So I'm sure a lot of people here are curious. You know, we don't have that many commercial galleries here. And so I think it's like an interesting conversation to have, but also like where you want to go. And I'd also be interested just to hear about, again, your experience being in Boston, being a dealer in the context you were. Mm-hmm. And we'll hear more about that after the break. We're talking with my good friend and longtime colleague, Camilo Alvarez, who is Dominican-American, had a gallery for 13 years, worked at institutions, etc., and is down here checking out our art scene and seeing what we got going on. And we're going to hear more about his impressions of that after the break. You're listening to The Blank Canvas, the show in which we speak about visual culture and creative community. I'm Amanda Coulson, the director of the National Art Gallery, and you're listening to 96.9 Guardian Talk Radio. We're going to be right back after this break.